Okay, the next case before the court is case number 21-1748, also an appeal from the Court of International Trade, Hyundai Steel Company versus the United States.
Reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal.
You should take your mask off so we can hear you. How much time did you want to save for rebuttal?
5 minutes, please.
Okay.
You can begin. Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Elizabeth Drake from the law firm of Chagrin Associates on behalf of the defendant appellant, Wellspun Tubular LLC, USA. It's nice to see everyone in person. I appreciate all the protocols the court has created to keep us all safe. This case below, which was called Who's Steel, but is now Hyundai on appeal, had two issues that we appealed. One is the substantial evidence issue, very similar to the one that was discussed in the prior case. But it also has a statutory issue, because in this case, the CIT found that when commerce bases normal value on home market sales, not constructed value, it is legally prohibited from making any adjustment to account for a particular market situation. So even if substantial evidence did support the particular market situation finding, the court said the law prohibited commerce from doing anything about it because normal value was based on home market sales.
So does that mean in this case, if we were to agree that commerce did not have the authority, that we wouldn't even need to get to the question of the substantial evidence on the PMS factors?
That's correct. If this court were to affirm the legal statutory interpretation issue, it would not have to address the substantial evidence issues. That's not true of the prior case where normal value is based on constructed value, so the substantial evidence issues need to be resolved. We believe the court erred in this finding because it applied the expressio unius maxim, which is inappropriate in an administrative setting. Basically, what the court did is it said, Congress amended the constructed value provision, but did not amend directly the home market provision, and therefore the amendment in the constructed value provision cannot be relied upon, or a similar process cannot be used when relying on home market sales. This is incorrect because under Chevron, Congress simply did not speak directly to the precise issue of whether or not commerce could address a PMS in the context of home market sales. The statute is silent.
And Can I ask a question on that? Before this amendment, there was no authority for commerce to do this particular market situation at all, right?
I would not concede that, Your Honor, and that is because there are a number of cases, including on cut-to-length plate from Russia.
Okay, I don't want to talk about them. Let's assume there was no authority, because that's not where I'm going. Congress had not specifically given commerce authority to do a particular market situation at all. They amended the statute, and they amended the statute specifically to allow them to do it in one section of constructed value. And it specifically, when it talks about it, references that paragraph, right?
Correct.
So your argument is that somehow Congress implicitly intended to give commerce authority where it never had it before?
So,
because of some general statements in legislative history and the like?
Thank you, Your Honor. No, our position is that, first of all, Congress, in the same act, also amended the definition section in 1677-15 to clarify that one of the situations that is outside an ordinary course of trade is a situation where a PMS is found to exist. And the term ordinary course of trade is used throughout the normal value provisions, not only in constructed value, but also home market prices, also the sales below cost test,
but
also
but
third country
aren't,
isn't
prices. In that definition, though, of ordinary course of trade, shouldn't Congress identify sales below cost of production as one place where it's outside the ordinary course and as the particular market situation as an alternative place?
I don't think that they were necessarily exclusive. I think that when Commerce was faced with the task of performing the sales below cost test, The statute required it, once it disregarded the sales, to then only rely on the sales in the ordinary course of trade. Then it goes to the definition section and sees that any time there's a particular market situation, that is not, and those transactions are not in the ordinary course of trade. So it was in a bind. It had to figure out how do we perform the sales below cost test with when a PMS exists, and if Commerce's resolution of the statutory question of the ambiguity of the silence was eminently reasonable, because the contrary conclusion that they could not take into account the PMS would have absurd results. Basically, what it would do, it would make a PMS more difficult to address the more severe it is. So the more a PMS distorts costs, the lower costs are, the more sales pass the sales below cost test, and then Commerce can never get to constructive value. And if that's the only place, they can address the PMS, then they're barred from ever getting there as long as the PMS is so severe that at least some sales pass the sales below cost test. And that cannot be what Congress intended when it gave Commerce the authority to address this particular market situation.
Well, does the amendment say that Congress can simply ignore all of the other mechanisms in place and jump to the constructed value?
No, and that's not what Commerce did. Commerce did not jump to constructed value. That would have been very strange, because the statute specifically prefers that Commerce rely on home market sales if there are any that are in the ordinary course of trade. Normally, Commerce can only go to constructed value when there are no sales left in the ordinary course of trade. So it would be very strange for Congress to give Commerce the ability to address these distorted costs, but make it more difficult to do so the more distorted those costs are. And so we believe that Commerce reasonably resolved this ambiguity, this silence, about what to do when there is a particular market situation and they need to test home market sales to see if they're above the cost of production and therefore in the ordinary course of trade. And we think the CIT's contrary holding was inappropriate and inconsistent with this court's own precedent.
I'm still a little bit confused. When there's home market sales that Commerce thinks aren't in the ordinary course of trade because they're not representative of the costs associated with the production and sale of the goods, they don't have to rely on them just because they're made in the home market. There are other avenues to get at this, aren't there?
So when they perform the sales below cost test, they can only disregard those sales that are below cost. If there are any sales that remain that are above cost, then they do need to rely on them. They can't just say, oh, we prefer to do constructive value today. We don't feel like relying on these remaining sales. They have to rely on them.
Well, when you're talking about foreign country sales, it says that you only use these methodologies where the administrating authority does not determine that the particular market situation prevents a proper comparison. Well, why couldn't you have just jumped?
Just use that provision. So that, I think Commerce read that provision as if the sales prices themselves were distorted by what's called a sales side PMS. So for example, there's only one customer in the country, or there's something that distorts the market for the good itself. The question is what can you do to account for a cost side PMS when you are relying on home market sales, when you've got a big enough market for the pipe itself in Korea, but you've got a very distorted market for the input for the hot rolled coil in Korea. And if they're not allowed to address it in the sales below cost test, then they basically are never allowed to address it unless they go to constructed value, which they can't do if the PMS is severe enough and distorts costs.
What happened before this new statute was passed to address this situation?
I'm sorry, what did Commerce do in the past, Your Honor? So,
where you have some that are below cost, but some above costs.
In the past, when some sales are below cost and some sales are above cost, they rely on the sales that are above cost.
And when you're saying above cost, these are home market sales that are above the cost of production.
Exactly.
So they're intended to.
So they're
they reflect the ordinary course of business.
Exactly. They're in the ordinary course of trade. They're a good basis for normal value because they're normal. They provide basis for a fair comparison because they're above the cost of production.
And when you say cost of production, what does that specifically mean? Because I think that's where the rub of this is, right?
Yeah, so cost of production provisions are actually very similar to the constructed value provisions, except for they do not include profit.
So. Because here's the thing. If these things are above the cost of production, why do we assume that they reflect any distortion?
Because the cost of production, under the CIT's reasoning, the cost of production that Commerce is required to use to perform the test is the distorted cost of production. So it includes those depressed hot rolled coil prices. So it's the depressed, distorted cost of production that they're using to perform this test under the CIT's reasoning. And therefore,
so I guess my question is, even if you're right about all of this, Commerce was very aware that these distorted market situations were impacting Commerce's ability, and they gave them a new authority. If they were aware that this also came in, not just at the constructed value stage, but at the normal value stage, because the cost of production, wouldn't we assume they would have put in there instead of, it's a pretty roundabout way that you're getting us there to do this.
Yes, if I had been on that committee drafting that legislation, I might have drafted it differently, but I don't think that was the CIT's role to say the Congress could have been clearer. The CIT's
I get it, but my problem really is Congress saw that there was a hole here and they attempted to plug the hole. They didn't do it, at least in your view, or maybe whoever's view, maybe they didn't think it's not done completely, but isn't it up to Commerce if it still finds another hole that Commerce doesn't have sufficient authority, rather than trying to bootstrap a portion that clearly doesn't apply where they didn't intend to apply? I mean, if the American steel industry wants to get this fixed, they must have some clout and they can get it fixed politically like they did with this act.
That would be an act of last resort, Your Honor, but the first party that had to decide how to resolve this ambiguity was Commerce. And we believe they resolved it in a reasonable way, and therefore the court below should have deferred to that reasonable interpretation because it gave effect to all the parts of the statute, even though they weren't, perfectly lined up with each other. It gave effect to congressional intent, and it avoided these absurd results.
Right, I was talking about. You're into your rebuttal, but before you sit down, I want to make sure I understand your Chevron argument. Are you saying that at Chevron Step 2, this is completely unambiguous and Congress has the authority to do this? Or are you saying that the statute is ambiguous or has a gap that needs to be filled and Commerce had the right to do that in the first instance?
Yes, Your Honor, that's our argument, that there was
silence. Those two?
Excuse me?
Is it ambiguous, the statute?
Taken as a whole, it may be considered ambiguous. It was why there's this specific direction for constructive value and not a specific direction in the other parts. But then also in the definition section, it makes very clear that you need to take a PMS into account when thinking about the ordinary course of trade. There's also, to some extent, silence in the sales below cost provision because it doesn't explicitly say you can do what you can do with constructed value. But whether it's silent or ambiguous, that those are both step two under Chevron. And clearly, Congress did not directly speak to the precise issue that was the question that Commerce had to resolve. So it clearly is not a Chevron step one type of inquiry that can be that. And it's not the kind of inquiry that the court itself can resolve in the first instance using the expressio unius doctrine. It needs that's not appropriate in an administrative setting.
Okay. We'll give you a full 2 minutes for rebuttal, even though we've kept going. But
thank you very much.
All right. The same division, Mr. Allman and Mr. Whitman?
That's right.
You don't have to go back over old ground to the extent there is overlap, but to focus on the issue we primarily focused on with your opponent.
Yes, thank you,
it's
Your Honor.
Your friend absolutely. On the other side, as we say.
I do want to make one quick point on the substantial evidence question, kind of relative to some of the procedural differences between the two cases. And this goes to some of the discussion in the previous appeal related to the directed verdict. And in this case, in the line pipe appeal, the Court of International Trade's remand language was the standard plain vanilla language. It went back to Commerce, and Commerce on remand basically said, in light of the court's concerns, we can't find a PMS. You know, so just wanted to highlight that.
Was that under protest too?
I believe so, yes.
But they didn't appeal.
That's right. It was under protest, but they, you know, following sort
the
of.
The court didn't tell them they had to.
That's
that
right.
They
the court said, reconsider consistent with this opinion, sort of standard remand language. To get to the statutory question, you know, we think this is a very straightforward issue. You know, Congress amended the statute in one place, the constructive value provision. The clause starts with, for purposes of this subparagraph, or for purposes of paragraph one, that's the constructive value paragraph.
Can I just get to what your friend was saying about how that, even if that's all correct, there's still this other problem that Commerce doesn't have sufficient means to resolve. And do you agree that they don't have sufficient means, and Congress needs to give Commerce more authority? Because I think on the textual stuff you're probably right, but it does seem like there's an argument to be had that maybe that there's distortive effects on this other thing that Congress, it's hard to get those two, keep those two straight, did not put in, but if they had thought of it, they might have. Or is there tools within the normal value thing to address this situation?
Thank you, Your Honor. And that's one of the main points I wanted to hit here. And, you know, taking a step back, on the respondent side here, number one, just think that Commerce has plenty of tools as a general matter. Specifically on this question.
So what would happen specifically if sales of hot roll coil are made above cost in the home market, but the inputs into that specific good are just conceitedly distorted by the particular market situation? How would Commerce address that?
In my view, the way Commerce would need to address that is to find that the home market sales of, in this case, line pipe, are affected by a particular market situation. That's in the statute. It's within the price section. Let's see, I've got it all spelled out. It's 1677B, A1, B, two little I, three, Roman numeral I.
This is why this stuff is a mess. If you have to get to that many letters of numbers. But
and,
go ahead.
And so that's the...
So what's the consequence of that? If they determine that, make that determination, does that mean they can then go on to constructed value and they don't have to use those sales in the normal value?
Yes.
Okay.
They, through that provision, they can disregard sales. And that's that provision...
Even if they're above the cost.
Even if they're above the cost. And that's the provision that's been on the books for years. And Commerce has addressed those cases. You know, you'll see a case where a company has a single sale in a market. I think some of the other cases are flowers in particular, where I believe Commerce found a particular market situation because the price in the United States was driven by holidays, Valentine's Day, et cetera, where you ended up with such differences in the market that there was a particular market situation that prevented that price-to-price comparison. So in the worldview where Commerce is left without a tool to address some input cost distortion, we disagree. We think Commerce would need to find that the sale of the finished good is affected by a particular market situation as a result of the particular market situation with respect to the input. So we think that's the tool that Commerce has.
So they can't do the adjustments in the normal course thing and still use the normal course. They have to make this determination that takes them out of the normal value down to constructive value.
That's right. That's how I would read it, and that's the normal structure for Commerce to address quote-unquote distortions that might affect the sales price of the good at issue. One other point within the...
Well, couldn't Commerce just do that here? I mean, if they really think that those inputs or those factors... threw off the input costs, then couldn't they just say that it's not within the normal course of trade?
if they did that, we certainly would be appealing it on the substantial evidence of whether that was...
But not as a matter of statutory construction.
That's right.
Given what you've just said.
That's right. If they said a particular market situation exists, we wouldn't say, no, you're not allowed to reach that finding because the statute clearly allows for it. The domestic industry didn't allege that here. Commerce didn't reach that finding because nobody raised it. They instead, you know, used the phrase through these provisions. If you read Commerce's initial write-up, it's we adjusted the cost of production through these provisions, you know, under one section, through the provisions of another section. So, you know, to answer your question, yes, if the other side alleged that and Commerce found a particular market situation with respect to our prices, in my view, that's the remedy that Commerce has. And it's there, you know, this isn't a situation where Commerce is left handcuffed, faced with distorted input costs that are rendering the prices in the home market, you know, whatever phrase you want to use, distorted or inappropriate outside the ordinary course of trade.
Do you agree, going back to my initial question to your friend on the other side, and that is that if we were to conclude that you're correct on this statutory analysis, that essentially moots the question of whether there's substantial evidence to support the other factors
yes.
in this case?
Yes, in this
with
case.
With respect to all, each of the parties.
Yes, yeah. And you know, just I don't think this applies in this case, but there could be a situation where, based on Commerce's you know complicated margin program, you could have a mix of constructed value and price to price comparisons. That sometimes happens where there's not comparable sales for a particular transaction. So you can have a situation where you would need to address both. This is not one of those cases. So here, if Commerce can't use the statute to adjust the cost of production, can't use the PMS provision to adjust the cost of production, then you don't need to get to the substantial evidence question. One other point on the normal value sales below cost analysis that Commerce performs, it's not just a simple what is the cost of production. One of the other factors that Commerce has to look at is whether the prices would permit recovery of all costs within a reasonable period. The reason I highlight this, it shows the aim of the statute is to evaluate whether the company is acting rationally in selling at a profit. You know, that's really what below cost analysis looks at. Is the company being rational in selling at a profit? Are they able to recover their costs? If you were to pull this adjustment into the cost test section, you'd be left with a situation where the responding company would be expected to recover costs it never incurred. The statute looks, are these below the cost, and could the respondent recover its costs? You know, because the statute recognizes and Commerce analysis recognizes, you might have some sales that are below cost. Commerce's normal analysis is if 20% or more are below cost, then those are outside the ordinary course of trade. Commerce recognizes you might have some that are below cost, but not a lot, and only those that reach a certain threshold get disregarded. And this goes to the recovery of cost test. Is the company able to recover its costs? And by increasing the costs with an external factor, that renders that question, you know, absurd, for lack of a better word. Is a company able to recover costs that it never incurred? And we think that would be an absurd result. So it's a long way of saying we think that there's plenty of tools in the statute for Commerce to address this situation. We think just simply pulling it over and plugging it in yields its own unintended consequences. And I certainly wasn't in the drafting room. I don't know what Congress intended when they wrote this. And the legislative history doesn't tell us either. There's these statements, yes, Congress wanted to...
You think the statute's unambiguous?
I think it's unambiguous. There's a cost of production section that spells out how you do that analysis. Congress didn't amend that. That part is clear. Congress did amend the constructive value provision. You know, that is a very ambiguous statute, but it simply doesn't apply over here. And just one final point, there's a whole subsection, paragraph F in the statute, that has a series of rules that are applicable to both constructive value and cost of production. know, there's so many logical places that Congress could have amended the statute in such a way that it would apply to both. They chose a path that very clearly applies to only one, and we think that that's unambiguous. And the CIT, multiple judges, multiple opinions, you know, reach the same analysis.
Okay, we're going to try to get back on track here.
Absolutely.
We went so far over the last case.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Winton?
Good afternoon again. Still Mr. Winton, chastened and a little terrified to be up here. And I think Mr. Rahman really covered the legal issues quite well. I was prepared to talk at length about them, but I think there's not too much more to say to help get you back on time. There is something that opposing counsel said that I wanted to correct because it's not right. The phrase ordinary course of trade does not appear in the definition of cost of production. It uses a different term, ordinary course of business. That term used to appear in the constructed value section in the same place, and they changed it in the constructed value section to ordinary course of trade. They didn't change it in the cost of production. So when you talk about ordinary course of trade, it's not actually in the definition of what is the cost of production, for whatever that's worth. If I can add, we put
is there any indication of the legislative history at all that goes to that particular change? That struck me as maybe a fairly discreet change that cries out for an explanation.
Well, here I can tell you there's not much legislative history. I can tell you, having been a trade lawyer at the time this was going on, and we put this in our brief, at the time that this law was enacted, the big question for trade lawyers was, what's going to happen to China? Is it going to become a market economy? Because right now we have this non-market economy methodology, which, to be a little flip and get into trouble again, allows the Commerce Department to kind of whack China with these inflated margins based on the respondent's side view. I know the Commerce Department would never say something like that. But that was the concern was that was going away. Because China, when it acceded to the WTO, there was a provision, and people argue about what the provision means, but there was an idea that that was going to go away in 2017, that we're going to have to treat China as a market economy. Now, in the end, China took that to the WTO. They withdrew the case. The understanding is that they were going to lose and that they're allowed to be. But nobody knew that in 2015. And so when you look at this statute and you say, what if your goal here is to continue to apply the NME methodology to China, right? But we can't call them NME.
But under a different
rubric. And so what do we do? Well, factors of production, right? That's really that we use an NME case. It's really the same as constructed value, but we don't use the actual cost. We use other, you know, we use surrogate costs. And that's why the statute in the constructed value section says if there's a PMS such that the cost doesn't reflect the cost of production or an increased trade, then you can use any other methodology in this section, which includes the non-market economy methodology. And then, but that doesn't get you all the way there, right? Because, okay, that's constructive value, but you have all these sales in China. And we all assume sales in China, costs in China are low, sales in China are below cost. So how do you get rid of that? Well, you say China, the market situation in China is such that you can't rely on Chinese prices for normal value. And so you say, China sales are in a particular market situation. We can't use them as the source for normal value. We go to constructed value, and in constructed value, we say we can't rely on their costs because it's all distorted too, and we can continue to use our factors of production methodology, calling it a different name. So that was how I understood it. We cited an article. Of course, it wasn't written that way. It was written more broadly. But if you want to say, why would the steel industry write this law this way? If your goal was, number one goal, I want to be able to continue to apply an NME methodology to China after 2017, this is a way to do it. Korea's sort of collateral damage to that, you know, in these pipe cases, because it's been applied to us. And I think it's telling when this first went to Commerce, they said, you know, this isn't it. This isn't a PMS. That was their preliminary decision. It was only after political intervention from the White House, from the Trump administration, Peter Navarro, that they, oh, yes, yes, this is, right? But I think the understanding of everybody was this was just a way to keep the NME methodology for China. But, I have an article by another lawyer that says that the legislative history is extremely sparse on this. Okay. Anyhow, I'm sorry, I meant to finish sooner, okay. But thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. It's not true that these amendments were made solely with China in mind. Just read Senator Brown's statements in the legislative history, and they are all about Korea and distortions in Korea, specifically Korea's steel market and Korea's pipe market. So I do not concede or agree with the theory that this was all solely to allow an NME-like methodology to continue for China. Under Mr. Allman's interpretation, it's important to distinguish, once again, the sales-based PMS and the cost-based PMS. Under his interpretation of the statute, once Commerce finds distorted costs, it then needs to also, which they say they need to quantify, though the statute doesn't require that, then it also requires Commerce to take a second step and say not only are your input costs distorted, but your sales costs are distorted as a result of those distorted input costs, and thus we can go to constructive value. And I don't think there's any support in the statute or the legislative history for Congress wanting to make it so difficult for Commerce to address a cost-based PMS, the distortions to cost. And Mr. Allman also mentioned Section 1667BF, which is the special rules for calculating cost of reduction and constructed value. And I will just say that even before Congress amended the statute in the two Russia cases that we cited in our brief, Commerce indicated that they thought under those rules, which only say Commerce will normally rely on a respondent's cost, under those rules, Commerce had the discretion to adjust or disregard costs that were distorted and outside the ordinary course of trade. They did not, in fact, do it in those two Russia cases, but they did previously find that that provision itself already gave them the authority to disregard or adjust certain costs because they were distorted and outside the ordinary course of trade.
Do you think there's any meaningful difference between the phrase ordinary course of business and ordinary course of trade?
Your Honor, I do not see a significant difference between those. I do not know why one was amended and the other was not. I would say that the term ordinary course of trade, while it does not appear in the cost of production buildup section, does appear in the section on the sales below cost tests that they have to disregard and only rely on those sales that are in the ordinary course of trade. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. The cases will be submitted. The last case.